Mission Bravo, Great Roland Valley, Coast Guard, we are reading you loud and clear.
Welcome today to SeaViews podcast. I'm really, really delighted that I have Adam Parnell again with me, my co-host.
Hello. How are you doing?
Great. Lovely to have you back. We are joined today by Cor Blanc, one of the founding members, I should say, of the Fish Platform. And that's an organization that was set up around 10 years ago, I think. You'll correct me if I'm wrong, though, Cor. And that's with the aim of improving international fishing safety. Now, that's a fairly big job. So that's what we're going to delve into today in our discussion. So, Cor, today we're going to be talking about international fishing safety. And it's really exciting news, isn't it, about this new international fund for fishing safety that's just been announced?
It's really great news, Julia. Finally, attention to the fishing industry that really support safety and health for fishers. I think it's an enormous amount that will be available for project on health and safety all around the world. So I hope that fisheries organizations, fishers, representatives, fishers themselves will connect and apply with very nice projects that improve health and safety for fishers. It's really outstanding, and I think we can thank the Lloyd's Register Foundation enough for make this fund available.
I don't think most people realize just how big the population of fishers is in the world and what a big issue this is.
That's true, Julia. Thank you very much. Hi, Adam. Thank you very much for this invitation. I think we can't pay enough attention to improve safety and health in the fishing industry, because not many people, as you said, are aware that there are around 35 million fishers and actually people going to sea catching fresh food for the world to make sure we all have fresh nutritions. And 35 millions, I often compare to the commercial shipping industry, when there are about 1.65 million seafarers. That means that every 24 out of 25 people with a profession at sea are fisher. And that's quite a lot.
It is an incredible stat, isn't it? Because we only have 12,000 or so fishers in the UK. But of course, when you start looking internationally, it's an enormous population.
It is. And like Cor says, it's really overlooked because, of course, when you see ships at sea, when you say to somebody about, you know, think of a seafarer, they will see somebody on, perhaps on the bridge of a tanker. But actually, as Cor says, you know, most of the people that go to sea are fishermen. And that might be an artisanal fisherman in a very small vessel, right up to some of these super trawlers that you see, you know, that operate right out in the middle of the ocean.
I think the ordinary seafarer gets maybe more coverage, more a higher profile than actually fishers. And from my understanding, 70% of them are in Asia, aren't they, Cor?
Well, that's in 2020, about 90% of the fishers are in Southeast Asia. As Adam just said, most of them are on small vessels. And small vessels, I mean, with a length under 12 meters. About 81% around the world, motorized fishing vessels are under 12 meters. And when you're talking about safety and health, that's already addressing one of the problems. If you look at internationally at IMO conventions, for instance, Cape Town Agreement, how do you build and equip a fishing vessel safely? The Cape Town Agreement only applies to vessels from 24 meters and over. And that's a small potential of the world fishing fleet.
Yes, that's a very tiny little slice of it, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
And it gets worse because when you look at the sub 12 meter vessels, quite often, the way they're built, they couldn't comply with some of the stuff that's in the Cape Town Agreement. And they just physically don't the size, the draft, the length to take certain equipment that people would perhaps suggest they take. So it is a very difficult topic.
How can you equip 5 meter length fishing vessel with a life raft?
Absolutely. Yeah, the life raft's bigger than the vessel.
Yeah, exactly. So I think in attention for safety and health in the fishing industry, it's good. One, to push forward with existing convention. And if I may, there are three major conventions internationally. One is the Cape Town Agreement. It's how to build and equip fishing vessels safely. One is on training and watchkeeping, the SCCWF. And another important convention is the Convention of the International Labour Organization, the Working Fishing Convention, and that's on working time, repatriation, medical examination, etc. And there is a need that we push forward these three conventions because the ratification rate compared to those for the shipping industry is pretty low. But we also have to compose, adapt and implement other conventions for the smaller fleet.
Yeah, there's been quite a lot of development in terms of the regulations, and a lot of the ILO ones were new and brought in fairly recently, weren't they? But that's not been adopted in every part of the world, has it? So there is a lot to do, isn't there?
Yeah, that's true. If you look at the numbers, you see that the conventions for the shipping industry have high numbers of ratification. So last, almost any country have ratified it. SCCW, the same. And if you're looking at conventions for the fishing industry, Cape Town is still not in force. Actually, the Working Fishing Convention, SCCWF, came just recently in force. And again, SCCWF only, part of the SCCWF only applies to crew on larger fishing vessels. So we still miss legislation for, let's say, 1995 of the fishes around the world.
So that leads me on really to why we need Fish Platform Corps. I mean, playing devil's advocate, can't we just leave this to the IMO?
Well, apparently we can't. And we have different issues there. The IMO is an organization, but the members of the IMO, the countries affiliated to the United Nations, determine the policy and which topics receive attention. Now, not every member of the IMO is in favor of regulating the safety and health of fishers. They won't say it out loud, but you notice it. In the recent years, we revised the SCWF, and you see that some of the countries find reasons not to include certain requirements. And I think that's where the Fish Platform comes in. As you mentioned, 11 years ago, we started the Fish Platform, and just for one reason, we were attending the European Maritime Day, and the only time that fish was on the agenda was during lunch, because fish was on your plate. And that was the moment that with a small group, we said, we have to do something about it. A group of seven people, and we said, okay, we will meet twice a year at one of our offices and then start sharing our knowledge, sharing our experience. And now, 10 years later, we have 92 participants from four continents. We share our knowledge, we share new developments. And what I like about the Fish Platform, all people come to give and not to gain. And they will receive interesting topics and information they can use, but that's not the main reason they attend. They will be part of it, and the positive spirit, and share and improve safety and health without any political issue.
Yeah, and it's such an important area now, isn't it, to work on? Because I keep going back to this very interesting imbalance between 95% of people potentially having an accident and dying are in fishing, and just that 5% are the merchant navy type seafarers that you might traditionally more think of. But yet all of the legislation and, if you like, the mechanism behind it, it all seems to be geared up for the 5%, but very little attention on that enormous population of fishes.
I think one reason for that is that the fishing industry is not that well organized. If you look at shipping, you have all kinds of branch organizations that represent the shipping. You have it for tankers, for cruise vessels, in general, like ICS. And the fishing industry is not that well organized. I know there is one, ICFA. They applied for the NGO status at IMO, but were rejected. So actually, besides the member states, there are a lot of NGOs at the IMO, but there's no one representing the fishing industry.
Until now.
Until now, luckily, yeah. Finally, the Nautical Institute opened their membership to fishers and are starting a fishery safety advisory group. And by that way, we can feed the Nautical Institute representative at IMO and make sure that there will be attention and there will be initiative taken to improve safety and health in the fishing industry. Mm. And that's what we do also do as a fish platform. We try to make impact, but on the other hand, we also influence legislation. While in the fish platform, we composed the content of the basic safety training for fishing vessel personnel that's now incorporated in the convention STCWF. We created fisheries safety management code, a lead auditor course that is organized also by the Nautical Institute. So in several ways, the fish platform has impact, and we are very thankful to the Nautical Institute that they embraced fishes as well, as I must thank CHIRP as well, because CHIRP has always paid attention to the fishing industry. And also many thanks to Adam, who has an eye for the fishing industry and really steps up to give them a better position.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. But I was actually going to return the compliment and say, you know, 92 members, I think you said 27 countries. And then you look at the impact that you're having, the reach and the traction that you've managed to gain with such a small number of people. On many of these smaller vessels, they'll be family owned. You know, they're not owned by a company. So being able to reach effectively family-run businesses across the world like that with so few people and with such limited resource and all done altruistically.
Thank you very much. I must say, luckily, I'm not doing it by my own. I'd like to mention Robert Greenwood. He pays a lot of effort. But in a way, it's true. We do it voluntarily. We're not getting paid. We don't have the budget to run the office. The only time we, luckily, and we were grateful for that, found some funding when we wanted to embrace the Asian region. Last year, we organized a conference in Southeast Asia to reach out to the fishing industry in Thailand, in Taiwan, in Indonesia, in Korea, etc. And we had a huge success. I was surprised because by the end of the conference, a group of participants gathered and said, we want something like the fish platform. And that's why in May this year, we organized the first fish platform Asian branch. They organize it. They have their own chair. They have their own secretariat. And we support them from a side, but we want to do them themselves because they know what they need. We only can support them, but they know how to implement, how to influence, change culture in the region. What are their needs? So let's hope they will have the impact and the success like we had when we started in Europe.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. Let's fingers crossed.
I want to also come to the whole reason for this. I know there's been a lot of improvements in safety in quite a number of fisheries. Perhaps in Europe, there are some real big improvements over the last 20 years. But the figures really do still show that there are some areas of the world where there really is some awful loss of life and too much, we would say. Talking about the figures, it's not recorded accurately around the world, is it? But should we just talk about why it's so important and what some of these numbers are? Because I've heard a lot of different numbers in terms of how many deaths and injuries there could be worldwide.
Yeah, I agree. The problem is that on a global level, we lack reliable data. Nevertheless, there are some estimations. I hold on to the estimation in 1999 by the ILO, where they estimated that on an average year, 24,000 fishes a year die in a fatal incident. And think of it, 24,000. That means 2,000 a month, 66 a day, and 2.7 fishes die in an incident every hour, 24/7. So I must, during the time we have been now, one fisher died.
And that could potentially be a conservative estimate, couldn't it, given the lack of recording?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And we were mentioning a quite recent report that even mentioned it's about 100,000. And that's incredible. We don't want to think about it. And think of not only those fishers, but the families. They rely on the income of this fisher. And not in all countries we have the social protection we have in Western countries. It's really disastrous. And that makes me wondering why we are not able to pay more attention to the fishing industry and the health and safety.
Yeah. Do you think that, Adam, there is an important role for really trying to record and evaluate some of these numbers better? Because you're doing some of that because you are open to reports from fishing vessels anywhere in the world, aren't you?
Yeah, no, and we always have been. I mean, CHIRP's been running now for 20 years. And when I looked back through our database in preparation for this podcast, right back at the very beginning, we were receiving, back in 2003, we were receiving reports about vessels getting hooked up on floating lines or buoys or machinery breakdowns or people falling overboard or getting hands caught in winches. And so, you know, all of the issues that we're talking about here, none of them are new. Sadly, they reoccur often. But you're right. I mean, CHIRP has always been open to those reports. But as I sort of alluded to when I was congratulating the FISH platform on its reach and traction, often it's getting people to know that you're there so that they can make those reports to you. And, you know, again, if it's a small business, family run, they're often busy, somebody gets hurt, you know, their first thought isn't, oh, I need to make a report. Their first thought is, how is my uncle slash brother's hand? Can he go to sea tomorrow? Is he still going to be able to bring in that family income? So, you know, these are all, each one of these incidents that we're talking about, you know, what's lost in the numbers is that each one of these is a human story. And in quite often, you know, a tragedy in many ways, because a lot of these incidents are doomed to be repeated because of the want of safety, awareness, knowledge, training in many of these artisanal businesses.
Yeah, it's got a huge impact, every death, hasn't it? Maybe we should start with some of the barriers. And what do you both think are some of the barriers to improving safety?
As I mentioned before, I think the application of the current convention is only to a small number of vessels. So that means that most fishers out of reach of detection of this convention, outside the working fishing convention that applies to all fishers. But then countries need to ratify, and we see there is a lack of attention to the fishing industry. One of the reasons could be, and I live in the Netherlands and I see the same thing here, that the fishing industry is under several ministries. So you have this Department of Fisheries, but that looks at tax and quota. We have a Department of Infrastructure that needs to look at safety. We have a Ministry of Social Affairs is included in working rest time aboard the fishing vessels. I think another problem might be that very often fishing is a bit isolated to local communities. So it's harder to reach these communities in the industry. For instance, if I look at Indonesia, Indonesia has about 80,110 islands, which about 6,000 are inhabited. But 6,000 islands at sea with fishing communities, and you have to reach them and change a culture and implement legislation also for small vessels. That's really a hard job.
Yeah, that is a hard job. Just literally the physical isolation of these locations.
Yeah, and I know in Indonesia, INFISA, that's a fishers representative group that really works hard and do a great job. But still, with these numbers, and if I look at the Philippines, they have about 1.1 million fishers, and they are on about 2,000 islands.
Mm. And I'd like to add to that list that Cor's made. So he's talked about governance and geography. I mean, they are two huge barriers. But even if you can overcome them, and that's easier said than done, then you've got language. How many languages are spoken by the global fishing community?
I can even give you an interesting example, I think. We made a training module and wanted to translate it into English. I was invited to a meeting where several fishermen from all around the UK were gathered. We created some time to look in the English translation. And then we found out that in the South, they had a different wording for a specific piece of equipment than in the North. So I had all, for the same document, I needed actually to translate it in the UK or in English, several versions.
No, I can imagine. And where do you stop? Yeah. It's amazing. But the other thing as well, of course, there's the means, both for our reach to those communities to let them know that we exist, either as a FISH platform or CHIRP or any other reporting organization. And then, of course, there's the culture and whether there is a culture of reporting. Quite often there isn't. And actions as part of a way of life, you know, so there's another real hindrance. Because I'll give you an example. I saw a report once, and I'm not making this up. It was written in Icelandic, and I had to use Google Translate. So the translation wasn't perfect, but it was recorded as a near miss because the fisher had lost two fingers on his non-writing and said, well, it's not an incident because it's my non-writing. And so there's this culture of almost, well, you know, accidents happen.
Yeah.
Why bother?
Part of the job.
Yeah. And then there's exactly cool. And then there's this whole thing about trust, which is, well, if I tell you that I've had an accident, who are you going to tell? And, you know, are you going to tell a regulator who's going to then pay me an unwanted visit, perhaps find other faults with my vessel, stop me going to sea and earning a living? So there are a lot of absolute hurdles that we have to get across. And it takes time, it takes effort. And all we can do is model good behaviors in any of our endeavors to try and improve safety and show people that, you know, we can be trusted, do hear them, and that we're there for them, and we're not the mouthpiece of another organization. And I suspect Paul would echo those sentiments.
Yeah, spot on. And I know that within Sherp, every meeting of the Maritime Advisory Board, there is this statement over and over again. That's it. The information that you receive is confidential only for this meeting. Delete it once the meeting is over, et cetera, et cetera. So if there at least there is one organization where you can send in your reports and fishing industry, please do. The whole maritime industry, actually, but we're now talking about fishing. Please do send it to CHIRP, because with everything you experience, you can help preventing another incident, an accident, which might hurt another fishing family.
Thank you. That's exactly what we try to do.
So what are some of the barriers at the individual level?
The interesting thing, if we talk about tuck and quota, of how much can you fish, can you catch in a certain area? Fishing industry wants to be involved, also with technical measures. They want to be heard, they want to be involved. They want to be on the same level as professional, as representative from a ministry. In my view, if you want to, act professional. And there are many who do, but still too many who don't. If you act professional, and safety and health is part of the professionalism, being a professional in the fishing industry, use safety equipment, use safety procedures. It don't have to be top-notch, difficult, whatever. But why are you not wearing a life vest outside on the open deck? It's that simple. And that's one, I think, one of the main barriers in the fishing industry as well, that people have to be more aware on a daily basis that they're not going to sea to die. They're going to sea to fish. They want to come home.
I have met quite a lot of skippers and owners in the UK, actually, who really do take pride in doing a professional job.
True. And there is a very interesting project. The RNLI had a program where fishermen jumped into a swimming pool in a safe environment. They did it once with a life vest on and once without a life vest. And they noticed the difference. And they were all, one by one, were convinced of the need to wear a life vest. And life vest is just one of the safety things we need to address, because it's all about doing your drill. Test your equipment aboard, because testing during an emergency is too late. And there are existing instruments that can help you. And I give you the example of the safety folder that's free of charge. It's a safety management system, and sometimes people fear by the wording of management system, but it's very accessible. You fill in some information, and it helps you to improve safety.
Yes, I think at least half the fishers in the UK are using it. But I've actually met a fisherman who is alive today because they did their drills. And I've shook his hand, and he is alive because his boat did all the drills and knew what to do when he went overboard.
No, but you know, those people do become the best advocates for safety. And the RNLI, or Royal National Lifeboats Institution, just to spell it out fully for people who might not be listening to this in the UK, that training is so effective, because each one of those people that have jumped into that swimming pool in full fishing gear without a life jacket, then struggled and had to be pulled out because they've realized, actually, gosh, this is what drowning feels like. This is how easy it is. They then become community ambassadors for wearing a flotation device or a life jacket. And as you said earlier, though, Core, too many people don't realize actually how difficult some of these things and how challenging reacting to an emergency can be. You know, to use a human factors terms, they are complacent. And I mean that in its correct terminology, which means that they have a belief in their abilities, which don't necessarily match the facts. People's skills fade through time. People's knowledge fades, you know, systems change. And as a result, it's very hard, unless you do your drills regularly, it's very easy to become out of date or not current. And the wake-up call should be at the next time you drill. You don't want the wake-up call to be the time you need to do that action in for real, in an emergency.
Yeah, you'll be panicking and you need it to be automatic. That's what the drills are for, isn't it, I guess?
If you allow me to add something else, it's not isolated to the topic safety and health. It always has connection with other topics, and I would mention quota. If you're in the area where fisheries management is based on quota on an annual basis, you only know for 1 year how much you will catch. but not for the next year. And sometimes it's very difficult to invest in vessel safety if you barely can feed your family. If also technical measures, like for instance, the landing obligations we have in Europe, all fish you catch need to be landed ashore. So that means more time to process it, more area in the hull to have your fish. So less commercial interesting species can come ashore. It needs more time, so little rest. And before implementing these measures, there should be an impact assessment on health and safety as well, which never has been done for landing obligations, for instance. The same is if you live in Southeast Asia and it's quite hard to feed your family. Do you have the opportunity to invest? So the inventions, we should not restrict them to high technology in the Western world, but also look to practical, affordable solution in other parts of the world where they don't have that much money to invest in health and safety, but their life counts as much as it does in other countries.
I couldn't agree more. And one of the factors that we should touch upon is sometimes it's availability. You know, you may have the means to buy safe equipment. You may have the desire to buy safe equipment. But if you're in a country where the logistics are difficult, or, you know, you're in a relatively remote community, you might not even have access to that safety equipment.
Yeah, there must be some places that are geographically isolated where you'd struggle to get even your life jackets serviced.
Well, I mean, how would you do that? Going back to that, those 6,000 Indonesian islands, where would you go? If it's a round trip of 3 or 4 islands away, you know, there's a huge disincentive.
So you have to find other means of floating devices that can help you, but also the legislator needs to take that into account when he implements legislation on safety devices.
Yes, because it's not accessible for everybody in the same way.
Well, that brings us full circle back to the IMO. Why can't this be done by the IMO? I have great respect for them, but they are operating at that supranational level, whereas we're talking about facts on the ground, and somebody in an office in London just can't conceive, and there is no way you can write a set of regulations that can be applicable literally globally, because the circumstances are just so vastly different.
But the IMO has an office, but is run by the members. There is a voluntary guideline for small and undocked fishing vessels. We can look at that and not make it voluntary, but make it a convention. And maybe it needs changes to make it applicable to every region, or why not compose something more regional? That you say, well, in Western countries, we make it on a higher level. In other countries where they can't afford it or there are too many small vessels, we change it a little bit. I know the ILO has also progressive implementation. So that means once you ratified it, you still have for certain articles, or maybe the whole convention, it depends on what you decide upon, you have certain years to implement this legislation. Not 1 year, but maybe 5.
I mean, there's a whole other podcast in itself, isn't it? Talking about the Working Fishing Convention, you know, the ILO's conventions. And they bring a huge amount of rigor, and they bring a good spotlight on lots of fishing practices. Because, you know, there is a dark side, unfortunately, to fishing in some parts of the world. And we all know where they are, so they don't need to be named. Where labor practices on board some certain fishing vessels are very, very poor. As Cor said earlier, all these things are interrelated. And if you've got very poor fishing practices, and in some cases, literally modern day slavery, the focus on safety is very unlikely to be a good one because of that.
Yes. And it comes back to a discussion about profitability, doesn't it? I mean, do fisheries have to be profitable to be safe? I mean, if we looked at Iceland, for example, it's very profitable and it's culturally probably holds a different status, a fairly high status industry within that country. And I think we'd say it's pretty safe, you know, when you're looking at it on a global level. And then some of the other areas in the world where we would say that it's not profitable and it's very hard for them to maintain safety. Do you have to make a profit basically to be safe?
You have to make a profit to remain in business. And, you know, one of the quickest ways of going out of business is not looking after your team. So, and as Cor said, it doesn't matter what your nationality is, all human life should be equally respected.
You need to make a profit to make it safer, I would say. Because if you don't have the money to invest in safety equipment, you might decide not to go out if you know there will be a storm. But that's challenging, because if you don't have enough money to invest in safety, you probably don't have not that a lot of money to feed your family. So you will go out, even if there is a storm.
Some financial pressures at various times have caused people to decide to go out quite on demand. You know, they can't afford to pay a second person. Some of the small operators have actually said that, that they would go out single-handed, even though they would prefer to work with two on board. But that's a financial pressure, they would say.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Oh, yeah, it's difficult. And what pops up in my mind is that there is a reason we need to have a minimum manning. If you don't, potential incident will occur, is there. And every incident in the fishing industry adds something to a negative image of the fishing industry. Let's say a 24,000 fatal incident in the industry is not something you want to mention on open day in a fishery school. You would like to attract new fishers. So we really have to do something about it. Beside that, in general, it's difficult to get seafarers and fishers. The Western society changed. You see that more people want to be ashore, more often, longer periods. More people in their 20s, 30s choose to work 3-4 days a week. And the fishing industry, also the fishing industry, where possible, need to adapt and try to make schedules where this can fit in. But I still do think that we can attract people. And also look at women, because I know in UK there are female fishers, but in many countries it's dominated by men.
Mm.
It's a small number in the UK, but seem to be meeting a few more.
The rise of the number of women in fishing in the industry, it can only be a good thing. We've been very negative about fishing and safety, and actually, you know, a life at sea, fishing is still a great life at sea.
It is.
Yeah, it's pretty unique. And that's what everyone that I ever speak to that does it says, you know, there are some hard physical work, but that there's some real unique aspects to having your office out at sea, and they wouldn't want to do anything different.
It's a way of life, and they do a great job. They provide fresh food for the world. They are proud people, and we must be proud of them. These people, hardworking people, for honest money. It's really great. That's really great. I'm proud to work in the industry.
Yes, and I think we should dispel a few myths. I mean, I meet a lot of fishing vessel skippers and owners in the UK. I find that they are intelligent, very business savvy, and they always say to me, I was rubbish at school. I never did very well. You know, I'm not very bright. And that's utter rubbish. You know, they are operating in a sort of in a risky environment. They're continually revising their risk assessments the whole time. They're managing other people. They're also managing a market, because unlike a lot of other businesses, they don't actually know what money they're going to get for their catch until they land it. So they're continually juggling so many things. So while we're talking about solutions, can we talk about how there has been some examples of improvements? And I wondered if you wanted to talk a bit about the Falklands and what's happened in terms of improving safety there, or pick another area if you want, Cor, but I'd be really interested in hearing about an area that has seen significant improvement.
You mentioned Iceland. The fishing industry was for years the largest industry on Iceland. So it's really part of community. And that made them invest over and over and over in the fishing industry, also in safety. And I think that's a very good example that the fishing industry is an important industry where you have to pay attention. And if you implement measures, technical measures, you can improve safety and health, because the incidents reduced enormously. Falklands is interesting because they did something else. They had the fishing fleet was largely from outside Falkland Islands. And if you have a flex state requirement, but it's not your vessel, it becomes difficult. So they connected the fishing license, the quota, to a minimum requirement on safety and health. And if you can't meet this level, sorry, you have to fish somewhere else. But you get not a license for fishing in Falkland waters. And that's interesting as well, because in the end, the core business is catching fish.
Yeah, so you get to the same outcome, but via a different pathway.
Yeah, exactly. So they wrote a standard, and also the foreign vessels need to apply, or at least need to meet these requirements before they receive a license.
I'm going to put you on the spot now, Cor. Where is the next area in the world that you would hope to see a big success or significant change?
Well, I hope the success will be everywhere, but we still focus on Southeast Asia for reason that the most fishers are in Southeast Asia. We started there, but I believe if we really want to have impact, we have to enlarge the group with representatives from other countries and strengthen the structure like we did. The fish platform is standing. We do it now for more than 10 years. We always have people who attend the meetings. We have people who just want to have the documents to follow because either they can't afford it or not allowed to attend the meetings, but we still share all the knowledge we have also with this group. And I hope that Southeast Asia can do the same. But it takes time. To be honest, it takes money. We had the intention to organize another conference in Southeast Asia. We don't have the money. So if there's any sponsor who would like to support us in that, please, you're very welcome. Because I really do think, looking at the take-up in Southeast Asia by representatives from countries themselves, Southeast Asia Fish Platform can be as successful as we are with our own fish platform. And once we have a success there, and I'm still not retired, we go to Africa.
Yes. So the next largest population of fishers after Southeast Asia, isn't it?
Yeah. But to be clear, we don't exclude regions. It's important everywhere. And we recently welcomed a new participant from South Africa, but that will be in, let's say, the original fish platform we have.
Right. You're already having incredible reach and impact, and that's only going to go further over the next year or two, I believe. So what is the best way for anyone to want to get in touch with Fish Platform, Paul?
Well, I would say send me an email, explain who you are and you would like to participate. And my mail address is cblonk@pelagicfish.eu. I think that would be good to put that in the notes. And otherwise, look at the website of the Fish Platform. My contact details are there as well.
Yeah, brilliant. And Adam, for fishers who want to report anything confidentially in terms of near misses, accidents, incidents, do you want to just remind people of how to report?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we can do it through our website, chirp.co.uk, or people can use the app. It's on Android and the Apple stores. If you look up Chirp Safety, people can do that. Both the website and the app are multilingual, so we can accept reports of communications from people in their own language.
Well, that's been very interesting, and I'm glad that we also talked about some solutions. But I do have a final question that I ask all the guests. I'm going to give you a magic wand, Cor, and I'm going to say that you can change one thing to make a difference to saving lives in fishing. What would it be?
Wow. Final question already. My goodness, time flies. I think that would be risk awareness. For reason that I think if fishers would be more risk aware, and there are already many who are, but are much more who can raise that awareness. If they are more risk aware, they would on a daily basis take more safety measures than they do now.
Yeah, awareness of it. Because if it's not on your radar, you're not gonna be doing anything about it, are you?
Exactly. And I hope I just had one, but I tried to smile.
That's cheating.
Yeah, that's cheating. I'm sorry.
Go on then.
Sorry. But at least I hope if the elderly crew, for instance, if an older captain or skipper don't want to wear his vest, then at least promote it to the younger guys. Because what we also see that the young generation who really wants to wear a life vest don't wear it because other members of the crew start laughing. So if you don't want to do it yourself, at least promote it to us.
Well, that's a leadership thing, isn't it?
That's a really good message, isn't it, Julia? That's a really good message.
Because that peer pressure thing is really probably quite significant in a tight-knit crew and a fishing vessel. So you've got to show that you do it yourself as the skipper, haven't you, or the leader?
Yeah.
Now, it's really unfair, isn't it, Adam? Because I always let our guests go first, and they always have the really good ideas. So now you are welcome to contribute your one thing that you think could be improved in international fishing safety.
Oh, gosh, you always give me the hard job of coming up with something different when my thunder's just been stolen. Do you know what I think the one thing that would help people and would save lives is be open, be transparent and communicate and be honest about mistakes. I've often thought to myself that who do I believe more? The person that apparently is 100% right 100% of the time and never fails, or the person that says, do you know what? I got this wrong. This is what I did about it. This is what I learned about it. A, they've got far more interesting tales when you sat around in a social situation. You know, it's always the times when things went wrong that are the more interesting stories, but also they're the ones that we all learn from. And at the end of the day, we're social creatures. Let's learn from each other. Let's not keep it to ourselves.
Julia, I think you have many listeners from the maritime industry, but I'm sure you have many outside the maritime industry. They can do something as well. Eat fish. If you eat fish, you invest and you make sure that this fisher has a profit as well and can invest in safety and health.
So I have to tell you, that's the end of our watch and we have fished all our quota. So I'm going to ring the bell and it's time to leave the bridge.
Fishing vessel Great Northern Coast Guard, we are reading you light and clear.